Welcome to Ekhatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI.
Welcome, everyone, to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into, well, one of the most revolutionary and, frankly, profoundly challenging novels in American literature, William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury.
It really is something else.
Yeah. We've taken, you know, a stack of sources, articles, research, our own notes, and we're here to try and give you a shortcut, a way into understanding this masterpiece. Think of it like a guide through a literary labyrinth designed specifically for your exploration.
And what a labyrinth it is. Faulkner, Nobel Prize winner, he's truly a titan of American letters, a master of what we call Southern Gothic.
Right, that style that dives deep into the decaying South.
Exactly. Often with these dark, mysterious, sometimes even grotesque characters. It perfectly captures the Compson family's unraveling, really. He's known for his experimental techniques, especially that stream of consciousness narration.
Where you just dropped right into a character's mind.
Right into it. And his unflinching exploration of the human condition, his fictional Yoknapatawpha County, really became this kind of microcosm for universal themes, a place where the weight of history and, you know, unspoken sorrows just hang heavy in the air.
Absolutely. Published back in 1929, this novel was initially met with, well, a good deal of confusion, baffled many readers at first.
I can imagine.
But it's now rightly considered Faulkner's masterpiece and, yeah, a cornerstone of literary modernism. The title itself is just fascinating, isn't it? Drawn from Macbeth's soliloquy, where life is described as a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
Mm-hmm. It's a pretty bleak tone from the start.
It does. So if you've ever felt trapped by your past or maybe struggled to truly understand someone else's pain, then this deep dive, I think it'll resonate deeply, even as it challenges your perceptions.
Indeed. At its core, The Sound of the Fury is about the tragic downfall of the once prominent Compson family in Jefferson, Mississippi. Their disintegration mirrors the broader collapse of the Old South's social order.
So it's personal and historical.
Exactly. It's not a straightforward story you can just cruise through. It's much more an immersive exploration of memory, loss, and the kind of relentless burden of time. It's primarily set around Easter weekend of 1928, but with these crucial flashbacks reaching back decades.
The central premise sounds almost operatic in its tragedy, doesn't it? The family's profound inability to cope with change, with loss, with their own spiraling dysfunction. It's just palpable.
It really is.
And all of this agony, this slow motion collapse, it seems to center primarily around one catalytic figure, the only daughter, Candace or Caddy Compson.
Caddy, yeah, she's key.
We experience the family's torment through the eyes of her three brothers. There's the intellectually disabled Benji, then the tormented intellectual Quentin, and the bitter materialistic Jason.
Quite a trio.
And then there's Dilsey, their devoted black housekeeper, who, well, she truly acts as the moral center, offering the only real source of stability and grace amidst all that wreckage.
Okay, let's unpack this. Faulkner doesn't ease us in at all, does he?
Not one bit. He throws us right into the deep end, first with Benji, then Quentin. For a first-time reader, Benji's section can feel like being dropped into this whirlpool of sensation, right? Yeah. Memories and present-day events all jumbled together.
It's incredibly disorienting.
Yeah. So how does Faulkner manage to make that initial confusion so crucial to understanding the Compson's pain? And what are the key threads we should be looking for in these incredibly subjective internal landscapes?
That's a powerful point, because the opening really is a plunge into the deep end. Benji's section, dated April 7, 1928, it's just pure sensation and emotion. Imagine if someone just like downloaded every raw thought, every physical sensation, every jumbled memory from your brain, and that was the story.
Wow. Okay.
That's basically what Faulkner does with Benji. His consciousness is fragmented. Past and present, they're indistinguishable, often triggered by raw sensory experiences.
Yeah.
You mentioned the golfers calling Caddy.
Right. Evoking his sister.
Exactly. Or the smell of leaves, the sound of voices. He exists in this kind of timeless state of constant loss, but without the ability to comprehend it logically.
So he's like a pure emotional barometer for the family suffering, like a living wound.
Precisely. He represents pure, unconditional love in a family that's deeply incapable of reciprocating it. Caddy is his ultimate comfort, and a recurring, almost poetic motif is how she smelled like trees.
Smelled like trees.
Yeah. So his distress, when Caddy starts using perfume, masking that natural scent, it symbolizes his sensing her first steps away from innocence, away from him.
Even if he can't process it intellectually.
Exactly. His agony on Caddy's wedding day in 1910 It's portrayed like a death for him, a moment of profound, wordless grief. And then his castration, a brutal act meant to control his distress, it just underscores his profound vulnerability. He becomes this sort of living monument to the family's tragedy, an innocent witness to its decay.
God, that's heavy. And then we move to Quentin, who's a stark contrast, right? Equally tormented, but in such a different intellectual way.
Indeed. Quentin's section, dated June 10, 1910, it really plunges us into a different kind of torment. It's still a deeply internal stream of consciousness, but it's intellectual, obsessive, like a swirling vortex of memory, philosophy, and just pure self-loathing.
And it's set on the day he dies.
Yes, the very day of his suicide at Harvard.
Mm.
So you know the tragic end from the beginning, which casts this shadow over everything? His journey is this psychological downward spiral, driven by an abstract, almost impossible ideal of Southern honor and this intense, almost incestuous love for Caddy.
Yeah, that relationship is deeply unsettling.
It is. He's consumed by Caddy's virginity and his futile attempts to control time itself.
He famously breaks his father's watch, right? That seems like such a desperate, futile attempt to stop time, to somehow preserve an idealized past that's already crumbling.
Exactly. It's a hugely symbolic act, trying to halt the relentless march of a reality he just can't bear. We see his painful confrontation with Dalton Ames, one of Caddy's lovers.
That doesn't go well for Quentin.
Not at all. It's a physical and moral failure for him, shattering his fragile sense of honor. He even imagines confessing to incest with Caddy to his cynical father.
Why would he do that?
It's like he's desperate to create a sin so profound it could somehow seal him and Caddy off from the world outside of time and judgment. His father, though, he's a classic nihilist. You know, someone who believes life is inherently meaningless.
Offers no comfort there.
None. Just these bleak aphorisms like, a man is the sum of his misfortunes. Time is your misfortune. And that quote about the watch. I give it to you, not that you may remember time, but that you might forget it now and then for a moment and not spend all your breath trying to conquer it.
Wow. Heavy stuff from Dad.
Yeah. And the symbolism of water, shadows, reflections throughout his narrative, it all leads to his tragic drowning in the Charles River. A final desperate act to escape the crushing weight of time, memory, and his family's inherited sorrow.
It really makes you wonder how much we try to conquer time, too, rather than just live in it.
That's a thought.
So we've wrestled with the internal worlds of Benji and Quentin, steeped in memory, idealism, loss. But Faulkner then yanks us out of that cerebral intensity and gives us a starkly different lens with Jason. He shows us what happens when that broken legacy turns outward into this ruthless pragmatism. What a contrast.
Oh, it's jarring. Absolutely by design.
How does Jason's cold materialistic perspective and, you know, his actions deepen the family's tragedy? And then how does Dilsey's section offer that profound counterpoint of maybe hope and stability?
Well, the shift to Jason's section, dated April 6, 1928, it is jarring. It's more linear, transactional, and just filled with this bitter, sarcastic humor. It's like a jolt of cold anger.
Yeah, you feel that bitterness.
His character arc is one of increasing isolation, cruelty, racial hatred. Jason really embodies the kind of spiritually bankrupt New South, where money has replaced honor and dignity. He works at a hardware store, and his primary obsession is just financial gain and control.
And his cruelty extends to his own niece, Miss Quentin, Caddy's daughter. It's genuinely shocking to read, isn't it?
It really is. He systematically steals the money Caddy sends for her daughter, Miss Quentin, year after year. He plays this cruel cat-and-mouse game with her, trying to control her every move.
Why? What fuels that?
It seems fueled by this sadistic need for power and a deep desire to punish her for what he sees as Caddy's sins. His petty sadism and financial scheming, as critics call it, are just breathtakingly awful. They expose the rotten core of the family's present-day reality. He is sort of simultaneously the family's reluctant financial savior and its emotional destroyer.
Driven by this relentless self-serving logic that just suffocates everyone around him.
Exactly. But then in the final section, Faulkner shifts again, offering a completely different perspective with Dilsey.
It's like a breath of fresh air after drowning in the Compson's dysfunction.
And it's a profound relief for the reader, I think. Dilsey's section, April 8, 1928, it shifts to an omniscient third-person perspective. Finally, a stable, objective view, a stark contrast to the fragmented minds we've been trapped in.
So we get some distance.
Yes. And her character arc is one of quiet endurance, unwavering faith, unconditional service. As the Compsons' black cook and housekeeper, Dilsey truly is the novel's moral center. the true matriarch of a family that has completely lost its way and is just hurtling towards demise.
She truly is the anchor in the storm, isn't she? The rock against which the family's chaos just breaks.
She is. We see her on Easter Sunday, trying her best to maintain some kind of order amidst the chaos. She takes Benji to her African-American church, where they experience this powerful sermon about suffering and redemption.
A huge contrast to the Constance worldview.
Oh, absolutely. A stark contrast to their nihilism and self-pity. The section's climax involves Miss Quentin finally stealing Jason's ill-gotten money and running off with a carnival performer.
Payback.
Which leads to Jason's blind rage and his ultimately futile pursuit. But the real emotional resolution, I think, comes in that poignant scene with Benji in the carriage.
Oh, right, at the very end.
Yes. His bellows when the carriage route changes, disrupting his rigid routine, and then his serene and empty and blue eyes when the proper route is restored. It symbolizes the fragile order Dilsey strives to maintain, and maybe the peace found in just simple adherence to a perceived rightness.
And her famous line.
Her famous, almost prophetic line. I've seed the first and the last. I seed the beginning, and now I seize the ending. It just beautifully encapsulates her role as witness and enduring moral consciousness. Mm-hmm. And it's followed by that profound statement about her and her family. They endured.
Wow. An incredibly powerful statement on strength and resilience, especially considering the context.
Absolutely, in the face of profound adversity.
So what does this all mean for us reading it today? Beyond the intense characters and the plot twists, The Sound and the Fury delves into some really fundamental questions about human existence. What are the big ideas Faulkner wants us to grapple with? What do your sources highlight?
Well, Faulkner uses these fragmented narratives to explore deeply resonant themes that honestly feel just as relevant today as they did in 1929. First, there's the destructive nature of time and memory.
That comes through so strongly.
Yeah. For the Compsons, time isn't healing. It's torment, it's confusion. Benji is timeless, sort of living in an eternal present. Quentin desperately tries to stop time. And Jason only cares about the practical present moment, usually involving money.
So their inability to process time leads to fragmentation.
Exactly. And an inability to move forward. Quentin's broken watch powerfully symbolizes the futility of trying to control it, and by extension, our past. It's like they're all stuck in their own personal versions of the past, unable to escape the shadows.
That makes sense.
Then we see the decay of Southern aristocracy and traditional values. The Compson family is a living symbol of the Old South's collapse. You see it in their financial ruin, their moral corruption. Quentin embodies the paralysis of the old, romanticized code, while Jason represents its debasement into just crude materialism.
So it's a critique of both clinging to the past and the emptiness of what replaced it.
Very much so. We also encounter the burden and power of love. It's presented as both redemptive and destructive, isn't it?
Yeah.
Benji's pure love, Quentin's possessive, almost suffocating love, Jason's complete inability to love. Only Dilsey's maternal Christian love offers genuine comfort and stability. She's like a beacon in the storm.
And the novel doesn't shy away from exposing uncomfortable truths about society, does it? It throws the brutal realities right in your face.
Not at all. It exposes the brutal realities of race, class, and social hierarchy. The quiet dignity of Dilsey and the other black servants stands in such stark contrast to the moral bankruptcy of the white family they serve. Jason's explicit racism and exploitation highlight the deep legacy of oppression and social injustice embedded in the South.
Dilsey's strength provides that sharp counterpoint.
It really does. Her strength, faith, and endurance offer a moral compass that the Compsons utterly lack. Which leads us to the search for meaning in a seemingly meaningless world. The novel's title, with its nihilistic undertones from Macbeth, is directly contrasted with the different characters' desperate searches for significance, whether through memory, idealism, materialism, or faith.
So is there meaning, according to Faulkner here?
Well, the novel powerfully suggests that meaning isn't just given. It's something that has to be actively created, maybe through love, faith, service to others, like we see with Dilsey.
And Caddy's role in all of this as the catalyst brings up another critical theme that still resonates today, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Female sexuality and society's response. Caddy's sexuality is this powerful catalyst that drives so much of the family's tragedy. And it reveals society's often hypocritical and punitive attitudes towards women's desires and choices.
Especially back then.
For sure. Her brother's varied, often destructive responses reflect a deeply patriarchal sense of control and fear. It really underscores how women were, and you know, often still are, unfairly judged and confined by societal expectations.
What's fascinating here is how Faulkner doesn't just tell us these themes, he makes us feel them through his radical narrative choices, through the very experience of reading. How does he achieve that profound, immersive feeling?
It's all in his extraordinary narrative style and literary devices. The defining technique, obviously, is stream of consciousness and interior monologue. It allows us direct experience of psychological reality. Benji's sensory primal world, Quentin's abstract fragmenting torment, Jason's bitter paranoid machination.
You're literally inside their heads.
Exactly. And this is combined with temporal fragmentation and nonlinear narrative. Past and present coexist, the timeline is scrambled, forcing you, the reader, to piece together events, mirroring the character's own struggles with memory.
It truly forces you to immerse yourself and actively piece things together. It can be disorienting, sure, but incredibly rewarding once those pieces start to click into place.
Absolutely. Then there's the rich and recurring symbolism and imagery. Water, for instance, symbolizes both purification and death, a recurring motif with Quentin. Shadows and reflections speak to memory and identity, constantly shifting.
And Caddy's muddy drawers.
A potent, visceral symbol of her first step from childhood innocence into a world of complex sexuality. While trees and flowers often represent her purity, or maybe the family sacrifices, Faulkner also employs linguistic experimentation, giving each narrator a distinct language pattern that mirrors their consciousness from Benji's simple, repetitive phrases to Quentin's dense philosophical prose.
You could almost hear their voices.
Yes. And finally, the brilliant use of contrast and juxtaposition Dilsey's dignity against constant chaos, innocence versus hatred, it just amplifies the novel's moral distinctions and emotional impact.
The emotional journey through this deep dive, it really is unique. You go from initial confusion to pity, despair, anger, and then finally maybe a glimpse of grace with Dilsey. What kind of lasting impression does The Sound and the Fury leave on you?
Oh, it creates one of the most emotionally devastating yet ultimately, I think, cathartic experiences you can have with a book. That initial disorientation forces you, the reader, to actively piece together meaning mirroring the character's own struggles.
You become part of the process.
You do. It's an arc that moves from innocence through profound corruption to maybe potential redemption. The lasting impression is of these profound questions about time, memory, meaning, human suffering, and endurance. The Compson tragedy becomes universalized, doesn't it? Representing common human responses to trauma and the heavy hand of history.
And through all the darkness, Dilsey just shines through as the enduring light.
She truly does. Dilsey's quiet strength offers this vision of dignity and meaning through daily acts of love, service, unwavering faith. It makes readers confront uncomfortable truths about race, class, and power in American society, while celebrating resilience and the power of the human spirit.
This novel doesn't just tell a story, it kind of reshapes how you perceive reality, reminding us that the greatest tragedies often unfold within the confines of a single family, yet they echo these universal truths about our shared human experience.
Definitely. And maybe in a world where we're constantly bombarded with information, often fragmented and overwhelming, The Sound and the Fury challenges us to ask, are we assembling meaning, or are we, maybe like the Compsons, just caught in our own echoes of sound and fury, mistaking noise for understanding? This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acantra Foundation.